Hello and welcome to the Data Science Innovation Driving Alzheimer's Disease Insights. I'm Gina Constantakopoulos, the Senior Director of Partner Engagement here at Matter. And Matter is a healthcare technology incubator and innovation hub built on the belief that collaboration between entrepreneurs and industry leaders is the best way to develop healthcare solutions. Our mission is to accelerate the pace of change of healthcare, and we do three things in service of this mission. First, we incubate startups. Since we launched 8 years ago, we've worked with more than 800 companies that range from very early growth stage startups to larger companies, and we offer them a suite of services to help at every stage of their development. Our member companies have raised more than $5 billion to fuel their growth. Second, we work with larger organizations such as health systems, life science companies, payers, foundations to strengthen their innovation capacity, and we help them find value in emerging technology solutions by unlocking full potential of both their internal innovators and then creating more human-centered healthcare experiences through system-level collaboration. And third, we're a nexus for people who are passionate about healthcare innovation. We bring people together to be inspired, to learn, and to connect with each other. We produce a lot of programs like this one today, including large-scale events for the broader community and small forums exclusively for our members and partners. Today's event is being conducted alongside our Brain Health Innovation Challenge, which you'll hear a little bit more about at the end of this program, that we're producing with support from Lundbeck U.S. Charitable Fund. It is an independently managed nonprofit 501c3 that is committed to the responsibility and appropriate support of programs about restoring brain health. The Lundbeck U.S. Charitable Fund is wholly owned by Lundbeck, a global pharmaceutical company specializing in brain disease, but for more than 70 years, Lundbeck has been at the forefront of neuroscience research, tirelessly dedicated to restoring brain health so that every person can be their best. So for today, for years, data analytics has been used in healthcare to fuel faster, accurate diagnoses, to inform decision-making, personalized treatment, improve patient care and outcomes, lower costs, and more. But with the recent advances that we're seeing with big data and generative artificial intelligence, more organizations are exploring how these new ways can take modern data science tools to address persistent healthcare challenges. So, talking about challenges, one of the key challenges right now in advancing care for our growing population of older people is living with Alzheimer's disease and the related dementias. And we're seeing that there are a wide range of disparate sources of raw data, including electronic health records, personal health records, patient portals, health-related smartphones, wearables, and lots of unstructured data out there. And the question is, how can we gain meaningful insights? Well, hopefully our panel today will help us to dig into that. Today, we're joined by Mary Furlong, a leader in the longevity market, Elizabeth Powers, the Vice President and General Manager of U.S. Regulatory Science and Study Innovation at IQVIA, and Ryan Urbanowitz, Research Scientist, Computational Biomedicine at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, and the co-lead of Tech ID and Training Core at PIN AI Tech in the A2 Collective. And our conversation today is going to just dig into this topic. So with that, hello, everyone.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Ryan. Hi, Elizabeth. Hi,
Hi,
Mary.
Gina.
Great to have you guys join us today. Before we really kind of dig into the topic at hand, I'm gonna go around the table and have you tell me a little bit more about yourselves and how you've come to look both at the growing older population in the US, brain health as it relates to Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and then this question of data. All right, so I'm going to start with you, Mary, if you can tell me a little bit about kind of you and your role.
Well, I've been at this a long time. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I have started three companies, and I think have raised about $250 million in corporate sponsorships and venture financing for startups that are building companies in the longevity market. I produce the Longevity Venture Summit, which I've done for about 20 years, and the Washington Innovation Summit, and I have a podcast called Longevity Deal Talk. In terms of brain science, I'm an advisor to the Canadian Brain Health CABI group. I've been part of Posit Science since the beginning, and I'm recently judging the UK competition for business plans related to research in dementia.
Thank you. I'm sure your wide array of experience here will be of great use today in our conversation. Elizabeth, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yes. So as you said, I'm vice president and general manager of a group within IQVIA called Regulatory Science and Study Innovation. Our primary mission is to find ways of unlocking access to clinically rich data, including new data sources, some traditional data sources like electronic medical records, but also new data sources like wearables and so forth, big data sources, small data sources, and really figuring out how to use those data sources in a way that has scientific credibility and rigor. And so we are in the early stages of building out some new research networks that focus on CNS, including Alzheimer's. And obviously, there are a lot of exciting treatments coming to market for Alzheimer's and dementia. And with that comes a bolus of research sponsored by pharma companies. And we are heavily involved in various efforts around that. So really happy to be here with you today.
Thank you. We're excited to have you and certainly have someone who's riding the wave, so to speak, of what's happening out there in the ecosystem. Last but certainly not least, Ryan, we have you. And I think that you are our resident data guru. So if you would please share a little bit about yourself, that would be great.
Sure. I'm Ryan Urbanowitz. I'm currently an assistant professor at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, as well as an adjunct at UPenn. I run the Herbs Lab. We do research in the development of machine learning and artificial intelligence methods, as well as their application to a variety of biomedical target data points or objectives. And our lab specializes in the development of automated machine learning tools, as well as interpretable rule-based machine learning. So I'm very much coming at this from the computer science side, data analytics side. And I've gotten involved in Alzheimer's research in particular over the last couple of years through the Penn AI Tech and A2 collaborative that's funding research grants for technologies and AI, especially applied to Alzheimer's and dementia and other aging issues. And I approach data kind of agnostically because I'm involved in a lot of domains and also because many of the challenges and questions in data science are kind of universal and generalizable. There's a lot of things that I think about in terms of Alzheimer's in that are unique in terms of data quality, what features to collect, things like that. So anyway, yep.
Well, great. I think we have the perfect set of perspectives to get our conversation underway here. So let's kind of pivot here, which is I'm going to start with you, Elizabeth, which is Alzheimer's disease and related dementias are on the rise. As we know, our older population is growing. And because Alzheimer's disease and dementia tend to have a later onset for most people, it kind of goes in hand. With the prevalence of these cognitive disorders increasing, it means that we're looking at more people encountering these diseases. And what are you hearing about some of the challenges in the marketplace as it relates to this?
So I think I'll kind of organize this along the patient journey, if you will. I think first of all, there is patient and caregiver fear and uncertainty about, what is happening to me, what is happening to my parent, my aunt, my grandparent, my brother, my sister. And deep fear about knowing an answer because of the implications of that from a caregiver perspective. Then once someone is within seeing a clinician about this, we're not. So I was just sitting here thinking, I've been working in Alzheimer's for almost 20 years now. And, you know, I think we're still seeing very inconsistent practices. It's not like, frankly, oncology, where, you know, there are relatively clear lines of care. There's not even clear diagnoses. And that is still the case. Now, you know, my own personal hope is that over the next 5 to 10 years, with new therapies coming, it will overcome both physician, patient, and caregiver resistance to a diagnosis, because there are treatments. Oftentimes when you're in therapies where there aren't really meaningful treatments, it can be very difficult to get to a diagnosis. And then there's just, you know, record keeping. Actually, what gets put into the EMRs is very different from physician to physician. And then there's the last thing I'll say is then there's the burden on the caregiver, whether that is someone in a nursing facility, step down, step up care facility, assisted living facility, or just in a home with family. You know, there has to be a limit on the burden that's put on the caregiver. And that's something that really has to be taken into strong consideration, both in terms of treatment and care and in terms of data collection for research. So I'll just hit pause there.
I think that's rich ground for us, I think, to play in. But Mary, I'm going to pivot to you next, because I know that longevity is something that you think a lot about, and kind of this growing population of concern around brain health, not just, by the way, you know, do I have Alzheimer's disease or dementia, but preventively, what can I be thinking about to do that, and kind of having a community of peers kind of focused as well. What's kind of your take on what's happening in the marketplace?
I thought I might size the market. So the longevity mm-hmm. market's an $8.3 trillion market. And then there's a lot of riches in the niches. So if you look at the boomers, they are at the top end 77. So in 3 years, they're going to be 80. And then you've got 20 years of boomer, right? You know, 20 years of older adults coming behind them. So it's a huge market. Now, the opportunity for innovation in the home, in the care setting, in the adult day setting, in senior housing communities, and in places with dementia wings, that's really important to look at. But we're just at the very beginning. I mean, more people watch Wheel of Fortune than that's their cognitive fitness. And so if you take an issue like driving, which I'm very concerned about right now, because you look at the number of people who are not going to be able to drive in the next 10 years, and we're not prepared for that in terms of accessing resources in the home. So some of the analysts think Uber Health is one of the most important new brands out there that can play a role, but lighting can play a role, pharma can play a role, and there's a huge staff shortage. So there's really got to be brand new models for how we find, train, and retain caregivers.
No, there's not. I think that that's maybe that's part of this, right? Which is that there's so much, not just from a standpoint of talking about the number of people that are potentially impacted by this, but the myriad of kind of concerns that they're starting to have to consider, right? Not just healthcare and data, but kind of these larger access issues that you pointed to that all have a role to play in things like diagnosis or care. So really interesting. I think I want to take some of these things, and maybe Ryan, I'll come to you next, which is kind of this notion of data. We heard from Elizabeth, you know, about data and relating to this kind of group being in lots of different places. As someone who spends their days looking at these troves of data, what do you think the current state of certainly Alzheimer's data, but maybe brought more broadly this, you know, older adult and population level data that could start to have a play into things. What does that look like to you?
I think like a lot of biomedical domains, you know, the data is distributed, it's siloed, it's messy. You know, we're still figuring out in many cases, what are the right variables? What is the right information to collect on patients, right? Like, what do we need to be collecting in order to target care or, you know, to monitor for care? So there's a lot of unanswered questions in terms of just knowing, you know, what to gather correctly, let alone how to do it well. And thinking ahead is really important. I think that's already been brought up. You know, we need to think about what the future needs are going to be and make our data collection systems adaptable so that as our understanding of these issues changes, so can be the way that we collect our data and the way we utilize our data to translate it back into patient care or help or whatever it is that we want to focus on.
And maybe, you know, as a way to take another kind of step back here, when you're looking, you know, day to day at these data sets, are you only thinking about things like the older adult and Alzheimer's disease? Or are you looking at other kind of patterns and approaches that you're taking elsewhere?
Yeah, no, I wish I could say I'm entirely focused on Alzheimer's disease, but no, I think very broadly about a lot of biomedical outcomes and work with a number of data types. Mm-hmm. One small example, I was involved in a clinical trial for getting my biomedical outcomes mixed up. But anyway, in this project, they had clinical trial data from multiple sites, and just harmonizing the data from these pretty well-structured programs was an absolute nightmare. It took, you know, 2-3 years just to bring this data together before we can even really analyze it. And, mm-hmm. and just this as a reflection of what, you know, the current state tends to be in the medical field in terms of, you know, being on the same page right from the get-go and how we're going to collect information, or how do we make use of the data that's already out there? How do we bring it together and leverage it in a way that is reliable and trustworthy?
Mm-hmm. And Ryan, if I can just dovetail on that, I mean, you just said that you were involved in a clinical trial and there was an enormous amount of effort to harmonize the data across sites. That's under the best of circumstances where sites are entering things into a pre-designed ECRF to feed, you know, case report form to feed into an electronic data capture system. When you're working with real world data, where every Epic, even if the EMR is Epic, every system is configured differently, much less than adding in data that is occurring from outside the actual site of care. But getting a sense of, you know, what is a person's activity level, what's happening with certain biometric, biometric data, heart rate, sweat, anxiety. These are all things that are relevant to patients, people with dementia. And that data gets very hard to integrate and is incredibly messy.
Absolutely. And one other quick sort of side note, you know, in addition to, you know, when we're thinking about collecting new data, another big point that might be worth discussing more is thinking about patient privacy concerns, right? Like we want to, you know, be collecting this data and so that we can make best use of it, but also how do we do that without, you know, patients feeling like they're being monitored or giving away their personal freedoms?
There's actually a question in the chat about passive data collection. You know, I think, so we're just beginning, so in IQVIA's business, we're really just beginning to see large scale studies come through, real world studies come through, where sponsors are hoping to have passive data collection, through a wearable. I mean, that's among what it really has to be in a certain way. But actually having a validated tool for that In my experience, it's still very much early days. In our view, it is critical for research in dementia and Alzheimer's to have this for a whole range of reasons tied to things I've already said. But I think we're still some years to at least 2 to 3, if not 5 to 10, from really having the sophistication of tools and sensors to be able to do this easily and without burdening the patient or the caregiver.
You know, it's interesting because, I think we do this in healthcare a lot, Elizabeth, which is when the first questions I asked you, you started with patient experience and caregiver experience, which is like that individual level of healthcare, which is so intimate and so personable. But at the same point, to make that a really meaningful kind of evidence-based experience for them, we depend on population level data, right? We depend on the roll-up of all of that to enable that personal experience. So Ryan, a question for you, as we talk about these disparate realms of data, development, production, living, little living spots, how do you think about population level data and unlocking some of those insights? Either for this older population, are you thinking that we need to look? What's your experience as someone who is looking at things like AI to uncover some of those things?
So there's already an incredible wealth of tools out there for machine learning and AI, some great advancements. Obviously, that's still an evolving field as well. There's a billion unanswered questions. But, in terms of thinking about analyzing this kind of data, the first thing that I worry about that sometimes can get overlooked, I think, is, the data quality and collection, right? And that is absolutely essential. You might have heard the phrase garbage in, garbage out, right? Like it's tempting to have this magical thinking about machine learning and AI. It's like, I'll just pass it to the tools and then I'll get something good. And the real meat of all of this is always going to be, what variables do I collect? What is the quality of the data I'm collecting so that I can leverage these, awesome new tools to really make the most out of the data, but at the same time, not fall into, pitfalls like bias, right? Bias is a huge one, making sure our predictive algorithms are fair, right? They allow fairness in their decision-making capabilities, as well as the information we glean from these tools and models. In terms of methodologies and making use of the data, I mentioned earlier, one of the areas of research I'm in is automated machine learning. And I'm actually just writing on a paper on it right now and surveyed a large number of AutoML tools, which is making it, a lot easier for people to use machine learning and hopefully do a better job. The problem with machine learning analysis pipelines is that there's a billion ways to make one, right? Everyone has an opinion, everyone has, belief, and there's a lot of right ways to do it, but there's also a lot of wrong ways to do it. So paying attention to the evolving machine learning AI field in terms of how data analysis is conducted, I think is important. We all taking a role in being critical of how we do that, I think is going to be really valuable in the future.
Well, maybe kind of taking a page from that, this notion of garbage in, garbage out, there are a lot of efforts currently underway, such as the National Institute on Aging is creating some data repositories. There are a number of other organizations that are looking to kind of create these data pools of information that has been well collected so that people who are looking to train their solutions, train their AI, have, data that is relevant and meaningful. I'd love to hear maybe Elizabeth and Mary, if you know about some of these kinds of efforts underway, what your thoughts are as far as these data collection and repository efforts that are happening.
Well, I know it from the NIA funding. So there's $160 million, I think, every year that they are funding. And I think about 60% of that is going into innovations related to brain health. And so we can look to the work of some of those entrepreneurs and see what they see. But maybe I should turn it to Elizabeth to say more.
So there are some data sets that are large enough, but with the evolution of treatment, I think what we're seeing is that those data set, what needs to be in those data sets is evolving. And so they don't always fit the bill, depending on what you're wanting to research. I do want to address a couple of points. You know, Ryan made a point earlier, and there are a couple of things in the going on in the Q&A chat here about, I'll call it broadly, social determinants of health. Part of what we're seeing with the coming surge of Alzheimer's, the existing and kind of tidal wave of Alzheimer's research that we're seeing is the need for more diverse data. And what that means is that you can't just go, so typically large pools of data have been driven through academic research centers. Those research centers skew wealthier, wider. I'm sorry to make mass generalizations, but this is what we see again and again, regardless of therapeutic area. And so we are seeing a push on the part of pharmaceutical companies and specialty organizations to really try and get attached to community clinic, community points of care. And what that means is that you're tapping into physicians who are not accustomed to research. They want to be part of research, but they don't have the practices, they don't have the staff to support it. And even then, getting, you know, there's also in the chat a little stream of, yes, so much valuable healthcare information exists outside of a point of care. And getting access to that also means that you're skewing richer, wider. So it's really I think, you know, there's one challenge in getting to the community physicians. There's another challenge in getting at the data that is happening outside of a care setting, and just part of day activities of daily living. That is really important. And I think we're probably 5 to 10 years from really having good, validated ways of collecting that data. I hope it's faster, but I think that the reality of that term validated means that it's a medium term thing, not a near term thing.
I think this is an important thread to talk about, which is, you know, the notion of social determinants of health. I think, Mary, you had that really interesting comment earlier about transportation. And I know in some of our earlier conversations that we had leading up to today, you know, you talked to me a little bit about banking and financial records, and you've talked to me a little bit also about kind of the role of that Secretary of State and the driver's license and what this means for older adults is to kind of, I'll say, outside the healthcare point of data that still have incredible relevancy. And I'd love for you to just maybe talk about a few of those things.
Yeah, I have a really great example. So I am renewing my license. And so I'm going to be 75. A lot of my friends are doing the same. And so they all have to take and prepare for the driver's test. And so I took the ARP driver's class, and my husband found for me a really good program with AI built into it. So it doesn't just teach you the rules of the road, it helps you understand the rules of the road. So in this class I was in, which was live, I said, this program will really help you understand the signs and everything. Well, people said, I don't have a computer. So when you realize that digital access, to your point about data sets, is not there for everyone. So the notion of just what COVID taught us is we first have to help people get digitally literate, and then that's another way to gather information. Otherwise, you could just have someone check the box and say, unfit to drive, you know? And so I think that's a big place that you see it. Banking is another. So older people are looking for things to do. And so they want to go and talk to the banker, the savings and loan person. They don't want the automated, necessarily want the automated ATM, because it's part of their socialization. And so it's the book clubs, it's the pharmacies, it's these local places where older adults appear, that's where you begin to see that they might just be losing it. So when their boyfriend tells them to withdraw some of the money, someone they met, you know, then the banker now sees that maybe something's not okay with mom or dad.
So it's looking at maybe some of these unconventional sources of data, and not just data, but, you know, potentially, you know, thinking about this a little bit more humanistically, contact points that we have in our community. But, you know, for a lot of those contacts, there is kind of a record. There's something that exists out there.
Right. I think the Surgeon General's report is really important about loneliness, and even the fewer hours that families are connected, fewer places that people can go and gather. And as they get into their 80s, they have often fewer friends, you know, because they lose their friends. They lose some of their friends. So we have to think locally, and we have to think very broadly about how do we reach these caregivers and how do we train the caregivers, many of whom do not understand the nuances of the research reports on things like dementia, but they're in the front lines day to day.
I think it's a really interesting point. Maybe Ryan, I'll ask you, you know, we've talked about some of these kind of unstructured data things like that we see, for instance, like notes in a health record, or maybe a banking flag or things like that. How do you, as someone who's looking at data sets, start to consider some of this unstructured data that's out there to help weave a more rich and thorough story about the populations that we're trying to analyze?
Sure. So first off, I guess I should acknowledge that I'm not really an expert on analyzing unstructured data. I certainly collaborate with those that do. You know, this is an exciting time to be in that area of research. You know, there have been over the last 5, 6, 10 years, pretty incredible advances in natural language programming, the use of large language models, deep learning methods in general to work directly with unstructured data to analyze that type of data. You know, I think it's important to keep an eye on these emerging methodologies. It's hard to keep track of, right? Because there's so many people working in this domain. It's hard to decide, you know, what is the most valuable research to focus on. And part of that is that from a machine learning data analysis perspective, there aren't really established rigorous benchmarking approaches. Every problem is different. It's challenging to say, well, this method works better than this method for these reasons. It actually turns out to be a whole can of worms. And so there is currently a little bit of faith in saying, I'm going to use this method and run with it. But in general, trying to understand the advantages and disadvantages to any given approach, typically with these new methodologies that rely on deep learning, the biggest trade-off for me is that, you know, you're most of the time giving up interpretability, which in medicine is often a huge selling point for methodology. We want to be able to trust our models and understand the predictions that are being made by them. And that's always been a big disadvantage of deep learning, despite, you know, the hype and the attention that deep learning has received. Not to say anything, you know, deep learning is also incredible. It does some pretty amazing stuff, but it's just one tool in the toolkit, right? We got to remember to use the right tool for the right job. And often that's not going to be deep learning for some of those reasons that I just mentioned.
You know, with that, maybe Elizabeth, you're sort of in the throes of where the rubber meets the road between these things, which is maybe traditional and conventional data sets, and then the understanding that they're not capturing necessarily the full picture. How do you bridge that chasm, and what are some of those things that you think about day to day?
Well, one is, let's start with counts, patient counts. Like how many, to answer a certain question with the required degree of rigor for the purpose, how many patients do you need in your analysis? And how are you going to get there? On some level, you would say, oh, it's Alzheimer's, it should be easy. There are lots of Alzheimer's patients, but actually finding the patients, and then someone mentioned federated data in the chat. I would add this idea of federated data to Ryan's list of wishful thinking. It's just not that easy. And because everybody's structured differently, similar terms, even among very, the leading experts, or maybe even especially amongst the leading experts, are used somewhat differently and mean somewhat different things depending on who entered the data. How you bring all that together in the end means that actually getting sufficient patient numbers can be tough. I think that, I feel like we've covered a fair amount of this ground, but we do think a lot about, are there big data records that we can go to? So we have another study in another therapeutic area where we actually are using driving records as an indicator of safety events. I've heard of research around gun ownership and Alzheimer's. As someone said, doesn't take much to get a gun. A lot of people are going to have Alzheimer's and they're going to have guns. And that is when someone mentioned this research to me, I was like, oh my God, I'd never thought about that. That's really, really scary. We think about things like that. Someone has mentioned prisons. We've been exploring work with prisons. It is very hard for a whole range of reasons. But we do try and push ourselves to think about how big can you get with some degree of reliability, depending on the research purpose. Maybe I'll pause there.
Well, it's interesting. I want to maybe pivot the conversation just a little bit as we're getting towards the tail of our conversation here. The first thing I guess I want to ask a little bit about is, you mentioned, how many people do I need to have a successful study? What is that number? And I would ask, because of the very nature of Alzheimer's disease and dementia, which is that it involves a person who is not cognitively at normal function, and sometimes is depending on other people to help guide them to appointments or create continuity in their day-to-day life and structure in medical records. Do you think, is that part of the reason that you all think that we have difficulty getting access to this, is because of the nature of this disease itself and the necessity for that, I'll say, caregiver role in its acquisition and, kind of regular study?
So I would say that a lot of the challenges in accessing data for Alzheimer's are in many, many therapeutic areas. It's the reason even, real world research is supposed to be more efficient and cheaper than clinical trials, and it isn't always. I But I think for all the other societal reasons that we've been talking about, Alzheimer's presents and a special challenge. Alzheimer's, psychiatry, you know, dare we even say the word pain, where, you know, we begin to ask ourselves, is it that actually there is that the science is nascent because there's a lack of data, or is there a lack of data because the science is really nascent? Because when you, I mean, look, I know there's so much research going on in Alzheimer's. I get that. But when you look at the way research has evolved relative to how research has evolved in oncology, inflammation, rheumatology, those sorts of things, the science isn't as mature as those disease areas. We simply don't know as much about the evolution of the disease, the methods of research, the methods of clinical practice, as we do about these other areas. And I do think that the lack of data, it becomes an iterative thing.
Well, I think that's actually really interesting and where we want to kind of end our conversation, which is talking about insights, right? Because the hope is that through using data more constructively, that we are able to glean some of these insights that help us create better care pathways, that empower caregivers to have more meaningful interactions, all the good things that we hope for here in healthcare. So let's talk a little bit about that interpretation part of it. You know, like, we're talking about all these things, these massive data sets, these social determinants of health, lots of points of for data to enter into the picture. How do we make that meaningful? And going back to kind of this patient experience, like, what does that maybe look like for this disease state? And I know this is asking us to be a little bit of that half full kind of perspective, but I think that's a good place to sometimes go. Maybe I'll start with you, Mary. You know, thinking about a lot of people, where do you think people who are going through some of this would want to see this data that they're participating in, their data? How would they make it meaningful? Or what is maybe some of the hope around that?
Again, I don't know if this is the exact answer to that question, but what I see entrepreneurs doing is focusing on the care managers. And the problem with being a caregiver, you know, it's an average of 49-year-old woman who's already got a full-time job and a family. She's very club sandwiched. And so to add anything else into that role is hard. And a lot of the caregiving is done by the family. But recently, I've been seeing a kind of new category. And companies like The Key, I think, do a really good job of finding great caregivers and educating them about dementia. So I think you have to look at the corporate role of who is playing a role in the caregiving economy. In fact, that's, you know, we're having a conference on that in December. And I also think AI can play a role. So those are I think AI can play a role in the training. So I think that we have to look at the people who are touching the patient, not the patient themselves, to build data sets around the caregiver economy, because that's the one that's going to be on the front lines pointing to this person has a problem or this person doesn't have a problem. There still will be a need to have research with the end user, and groups like CABI and the group in the UK, they're beginning to create panels where you can aggregate and find some of those data samples.
Thanks, Mary. I think that's, you know, food for thought. Ryan, when you think about kind of that, the synthesis, the so what of it all, what are things that you're thinking about?
Sorry,
data is wonderful, but if we can't distill it to have a meaningful insight that can change either a care pathway or inform how people should be approaching their disease management. It's just data and numbers. So how do we do that? How do we, you know, look for those insights?
Gotcha. I mentioned transparent or interpretable machine learning. That's one element that I always sort of fall back to as being important. And like I said, there's a lot of hype around AI technologies that are very much black boxes. They're opaque. And so I'd like to see more research and researchers developing and using methods that are directly interpretable. There's a small subset of us out there, but we're largely overwhelmed. So that's one thing to pay attention to. Focusing on understanding, you know, what are the variables that are important in our data sets, and what else we should be collecting. So, you know, when we're analyzing data, I feel like one question we should always have in the back of our heads is, if I was to do this study again, you know, in the future, what would I want to collect instead? You know, what would be better variables or a better way to collect the data? Another thing that's important, you know, on the topic of data size and fairness, right? Most people, when they think of data collection, they think more is better. And, you know, that is in most cases true, right? We need more data to have more power, have more confidence. But with larger data sets, you know, typically they're going to end up, you know, being messier. They're going to be more heterogeneous, which is both good and bad. It's good because we're representing a greater diversity of people, hopefully, if we're doing a good job gathering a broader data set. But the downside is that a lot of methodologies are not really set up, you know, in analyzing data to consider this heterogeneity. And when I mean heterogeneity, I don't just mean different backgrounds, but I mean heterogeneous associations, where if we're trying to predict an outcome, the factors that contribute to the occurrence of that outcome can be very different for different groups of people. So, you know, this group of people over here, they get the disease due to these genes. And over here, it's this combination environment and some maybe other gene and beyond. And a lot of methodologies that we have, they're just trying to put together the one best holistic model that's going to make a decision for everyone. And that's a problem in itself from a methodological perspective. This is an area that we're interested in, we study. And again, I'd like to see more people just take this into consideration and think about, you know, what methodologies could we develop or could we improve to tackle those kinds of problems. Might be a little bit in the weeds, but.
Oh, you know what, this is all about creating these data insights. So I don't think it's in the weeds at all. And hopefully we have people sitting on the line that are thinking very much in the same way that you are about this. And maybe Elizabeth, I'll give you kind of the last call on this one, which is, you know, what are those insights? What's the things that we're hoping to glean? What are some of the things that you'd like to glean as you're thinking about this?
So when I look at what, you know, what one can look at the pharma pipeline for treatment, and it seems to me that there is a shift to earlier and earlier treatment. This is harder and harder. This is hard to do because diagnosis doesn't always happen early. And I've been monitoring the chat all along here, but someone mentioned something about, could we do something like what was done during COVID, where many people, unfortunately, I think not enough, but many people shared their data in some way. And I think that being able to get access to data in a way that allows us to understand what early diagnosis really looks like and begin to develop some more definitive early diagnosis, there's a lot to be overcome in that. We've talked about a lot of that here just in the last hour, but I would really like to begin to see more rigor around early diagnosis, more concrete understanding of what early disease looks like and what both patient and provider and payer, you know, systemically, what does that need to look like? Because that is not where our system is early diagnosis is not where our system is geared to.
I think
it's going to be essential for good treatment.
I see Mary and Ryan nodding aggressively. Yeah. Go ahead.
I just want to say, I really agree with you about the identification of a patient population that can participate in that early diagnosis. And I think that's where you're going to get the motivation of the end user to participate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think this is, a good example for an opportunity for maybe citizen science, right? How do you get people engaged? How do you give them incentives to be engaged in either providing data or helping us to understand early detection, and at the same time, link that to a direct benefit to them?
Well,
wild idea, which is why not make it fun? You know, so Aegis Innovation has partnered with ARP to stimulate new people to play games, they launch new games like Monopoly and Trivial Pursuit with many generations. But one of the things older people talk about is, using gaming to keep their brains active, like the crossword puzzle. So if you kind of begin with what they're doing, 150 million people watch Wheel of Fortune. Talk about an audience and a population. And I was at a memorial for a woman who was 102, and the secret was Wheel of Fortune, keeping that brain active in her book club. So I kind of think we need like a big initiative to get people to get motivated and to make brain health as important as physical health and cardiac health.
Well, I love this. I think we've heard everything from citizen scientists to extended multi-generational gameplay from Mary and Elizabeth's concerns about keeping the caregiver involved and staying patient-centric. I think ultimately what we've heard is there's lots of opportunity here. So I'm actually going to say at this point, thank you to all of my guests today for your really, poignant insights, for your experience in your relative fields. I think there's a lot to be done here. So with that, thank you for joining us today. We're thrilled to have had you, and we hope that you'll visit us for more information. Have a great day.